Good morning. It's good to get the screen up now. This last Sunday, many of us experienced the joy of watching Theater of the Beats performance of Selah's song. And in a moment, we'll have some pictures shared. And I'll flip through a few of them here. It was a wonderful evening. A lot of us were there. Some of you weren't. Let's see if this works here. I think I have it on. Maybe I'll just cue, if it's okay, Sue, for you to scroll through the pictures and I'll tell you when to stop. We'll get a little bit of insight of what it looked like. So that was their merch table there right before we got into the sanctuary. There we go. So there's the play in action. All of us there watching, enjoying. Let's go to the next one. This is a close-up now. Unfortunately, this is not a close-up from our performance. It was from a different one, but I liked it so much, and it's pretty much exactly what it looked like. Go to the next one. And that was at the talk back with the cast and crew afterwards, where we got to have them share a little bit about their passions for this play and what it might mean for us. And that was the ice cream social afterwards, which was a hit. There's a few pictures there. Let's go through. And I think one more. Oh, there we go. Awesome. And then we can go to the next one and stay there. Perfect. For those of you who were unable to make it out, Selah's song is a funny, playful, and thought-provoking musical telling the story of a young girl, Selah, who loved to sing. Selah belongs to a farming family and is growing up under the shadow of war. Early on in the play, we learn that her father has recently returned from the front lines of the war and was experiencing the difficulties that come with trying to return to a sense of normal life after seeing the horrors of war. But things back home were anything but normal for Selah and her father, as the king was making life exceedingly difficult for a peasant family like them. The brutal king exacted greater and greater war taxes on the population and threatened conscription, or worse, the dungeon, for those who refused or were unable to pay their taxes. Unsurprisingly, the king needed to find a way to make the war palatable and the taxes palatable to the people who were tired of it all. And so the king's propaganda machine got to work, literally drumming up a song to indoctrinate the population and make the law of the land, the rules, and the war seem all too necessary to maintain the order of things. The spirited, wise, and courageous young Selah saw through it all, however. She saw how the rules of the king were unfair, and how the war was wreaking havoc on her father, principally, but also on her village. And so Selah, who loved to sing, wrote a song challenging the king's song, a song that became an anthem for peace between the warring villages. Many of you might remember the chorus. This is how it went. Let's see how this goes and see if some of you can pick it up. Won't you sing, sing, sing with me? Won't you sing a song of peace? Won't you sing, sing, sing with me? Won't you sing a song of peace? There were also four verses to Selah's song. And while I won't sing those all for you, I do want to spend some time reflecting on the first and last verses, since I think they can help us think through our scriptures for today, as well as think through what it means to prepare the way of the Lord this Advent season as we anticipate the coming restoration of God in Jesus. The first verse of the song goes like this, and if we could have the next page of the slides, that'd be great. Whenever I plant a seed in the ground, I wonder what it's going to do. Will it find just what it needs in the soil? Will it find a way to take root? Will it poke through the surface somewhere? Will it push up and reach for the sky? Will it sprout grow and drink in the air. Will it wave leaves of green way up high? As was already mentioned, Selah is part of a farming family. So not surprisingly, she sings songs derived from her embodied experience of planting seeds. But as the last verse of the song makes clear, the planting of seeds also becomes a metaphor for the life-giving potential of her song. How it is like a seed planted in the soil of the world around her, her family, and her village. Will her song take root? Could it change the way things are in the broken world she lives in? Selah doesn't know the answer to these questions in advance. All she can do is prepare for a better future by planting the seeds she's been given. And so she decides to keep on singing. Like John the Baptist, she is a voice crying in the wilderness. Listen to Selah's resolve in the final verse of the song. And if we could get the next slide, that'd be great. So I guess I'll keep planting my seeds in the ground, never knowing if they will take root. And I will keep singing my songs in the air, never knowing what they will do. Because the drumbeat of war that we hear everywhere is a sound so afraid and alone. But there's another drummer drumming somewhere with a rhythm that's calling us home. Selah's song is admittedly a small offering to the world, and she can't calculate or have total control over how far her song travels, but she can keep singing, and in singing, she can embody hope for a different world than the one she was living in at the time. Singing, as the last line of this last verse indicates, becomes Selah's way of tuning her life into a different rhythm than the world around her, a rhythm led not by the drumbeat of war, but by a different drummer entirely. I couldn't help but think here and picture Selah, this young girl, as an image of God. A young girl gardening, planting seeds playfully, and with the hope that something good comes of them. Given our scriptures for today, I also couldn't help but hear some resonances or harmonies between Selah's song and Isaiah's song that we heard read earlier. Remember how Isaiah 11 started with an agricultural metaphor too? Not a seed, but a shoot coming from the stalk of Jesse. Isaiah 2 sang a song of hope about new life growing in Israel, in a time when war and injustice ran rampant. And wouldn't you know, just as Selah's song was a song of peace, so too is Isaiah's. After all, there are those much-loved verses, verses 6 through 9, that give us the images of the future day when peace and harmony in the world will be so widespread that the wolf will dwell with the lamb and the infant will play by a viper's hole. We often forget, however, that bracketing these much-loved verses are verses describing the coming one, a king who will make such a peace possible. Peace and harmony for Isaiah don't come in an instant, and neither are they realized without a reckoning. Notably, Isaiah says that the coming king will make peace possible by bringing right judgment on the people and affecting justice in the land. Isaiah's song of peace has a bit of a sharp edge to it, in other words. This coming king isn't just about reconciling lions and lambs. Rather, in contrast to the corrupt kings of this generation, this king will render verdicts rightly and justly and will judge those who have done wrong. Such a king was notably absent in Isaiah's time, and was certainly absent in Selah's village of East Candling. While major power players in our society often like to keep up the appearance of benevolently providing peace and well-being for the people, often there's more going on than meets the eye. And notably, Isaiah speaks of the coming king as one who will look beneath the surface, who will not judge based on what his eyes see or his ears hear. Rather, he will judge by the Spirit of God that has rested on him. Too often what our eyes see and our ears hear are the standards of justice that the world takes for granted. Standards and rules that too often favor the powerful and keep the lowly down. In the play, Selah struggled with these standards and rules too. Them's the rules, she was told. But she could see that injustice was baked into some of those rules. And so the rules couldn't always be trusted. Selah's song had its own sharp edge to it, in other words, making judgments on the rules of the land that were unfair and looking forward for a truer justice. One of the key tensions in the play centered around a question. Can a song really change things? Can a song really prepare us for and indeed even help us bring about a new world? Can a song really harness the power that is necessary to effect change? Yesterday, when I was driving in the car with Micah, he asked me a question. Dad, who do you think has the most power in the world? The question really struck me because it made me think, who has the most power in the world? How do we usually think of power? And how does that determine how we decide who has the most of it? When we say that a song is powerful, do we mean the same thing as saying that a nation's military is powerful? On one level, it's so easy to look at the major players in our world with weapons of war that far exceed what we can even imagine and say that clearly they have the most power. And there's no question that they do have power to effect real and devastating change throughout our entire world. And yet there are countless other instances throughout history where we see those deemed powerless or small or insignificant. We see that they are able to effect immense change through imaginative and creative means. Change through protests, change through civil disobedience, change through simple acts of kindness, and change, yes, through even a song. Often it's seen as naive and irresponsible to talk about addressing the unrest and injustice of our world through a song, when what is really needed is a show of force equal and indeed even greater than the enemy's own show of force. And yet, interestingly, Isaiah paints a picture of the great power that words can have in the form of yet another description of this coming king. Listen to what verse 5 says. Maybe it struck you when you heard it. And he shall strike the land with the rod of his mouth, with the breath from his lips, put the wicked to death. Whoa. What happened to the song of peace? We might wonder. Robert Alter, scholar and gifted translator of the Hebrew Bible, offers a note on this jarring verse. And if I could get this slide up there, he says this. The formulation, he shall strike the land with the rod of his mouth, is a pointed oxymoron. Striking the land, and in the second verse, killing the wicked, are violent acts. But this king will somehow realize these ends necessary to justice through speech, in keeping with the Spirit of the Lord that has rested on him. We might rightly be repulsed by the language of striking land and killing the wicked, but Alter's suggestion that this language becomes oxymoronic when framed as speech acts should make us ponder a bit more just how speech and the breath of this coming king can bring significant power that affects justice. And it should make us ponder how our speech and our breath can affect justice in the face of unrest and violence. Given our discussion of Selah's song of peace this morning, I wonder, what if we saw this coming king as affecting justice through a song that immobilized or even destroyed the forces of injustice and destruction? There's something powerful about speech and about song, powerful enough to bring down the powerful from their thrones powerful enough to effect social change, and powerful enough to inspire us to change our lives to reflect the justice and peace of God. After all, as Selah's song teaches us, justice is not just about the good rulers replacing the bad ones so that justice can be implemented by them while the rest of us sit idly by. Rather, justice is about the whole community living in right relationship and standing together to build a better world for everyone. Despite being backed into a corner, Selah still had a choice. She might have refused to sing her song, and she almost did. She almost gave in to the king's propaganda. She might have decided that the world as it was would never change, and that it could never be restored to something beautiful. But others encouraged her to keep singing, and she did. And it made a world of difference. This Advent, I encourage all of us to ask ourselves, what songs has God given us to sing? Do we believe that our song can be part of bringing God's new restored world into being? Isaiah, John, and Selah invite us to believe that they can. Like Selah's song, our songs are small offerings to the world, and we can't calculate or have total control over how far those songs will travel, but we can keep singing. And in singing, we can prepare for and embody hope for a different world than the one we're living in now. Bloomingdale Mennonite Church might be a small voice in the wilderness, but God's Spirit can use us to prepare the way for the coming restoration. In the meantime, our songs can help tune our lives into God's rhythm, a rhythm led by the babe whose advent we anticipate this season. May all of us, then, prepare for this coming one by singing songs of peace in defiance of a world at war. May we all sing songs of peace to prepare room in our noisy lives for God's Spirit to give us wisdom and knowledge and courage. May we all sing songs of peace to prepare for a different world led by a different ruler. May we sing Isaiah's song, John the Baptist's song, sing Selah's song, and by God's grace, may we sing a new world into being. Amen.
Please join me in singing number 809, Sing a New World into Being. Familiar tune, new words. Please stand to sing.